Erich von Däniken is 73 years old. Controversial Swiss author, best known for his books, which present claims for evidence of extraterrestrial influences on human culture. Most prominently, Chariots of the Gods, where he believes that ancient astronauts visited this planet and might have been interpreted as gods. In a moment, Patrick Cook joins us with his theories. The Greatest Deception, next on Coast to Coast AM. Patrick Cook is an author, publisher, theologian, and independent researcher. His main work, the Bible UFO Connection website, is one of the most comprehensive databases on UFO research, exotheology, the paranormal, human destiny, end times prophecy on the Internet. It's going to be a classic night on Coast to Coast. Patrick, how are you?
I'm fine, George, and thank you very much for inviting me to be on Coast to Coast, and I'd like to wish you and the listeners a very abundant and joyful Thanksgiving.
You too, Patrick. Thank you. That's very, very kind of you. You know, since I was a kid, I've been just fascinated with the work of Erich von Däniken, and you seem to have looked into his work quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you think? What'd you think of what he has done?
Well, I have the greatest respect for Erich von Däniken, and credit him with breaking the ground on the amazing disclosure of our past. We only disagree on what these beings are, but in sync on almost every other aspect of our research. I have not used any of his research in my work, but he broke the ground that I am now walking upon.
Absolutely. Of course, you know, Erich has written books. 26 books have been translated to more than 20 languages, 60 million copies worldwide. He's got a television documentary and some shows out there that have been seen by millions as well. His theories basically say that we have been visited by ancient astronauts from other lands, and that they were human beings that were on this planet, saw these beings come down and thought they were gods. And you believe the other way around, indeed. Now, tell me a little bit about yourself, Patrick, beyond just the little bio I read.
Well, I was basically raised from the age of 9 years old to become a Baptist minister in the American Convention. I went to seminary at the age of 15, but unfortunately had doctrinal disagreements with the church and left before I was ordained. I have now spent the last 3 decades researching what has now proven to be a lifelong work. And I have studied comparative theology, exotheology, which of course is the study of alien influences in our religions. I'm an eschatologist, which means I study the end times prophecies of mankind. And it's been an absolutely fascinating ride, I'll tell you that much.
And we're going to tie a lot of this in tonight, Patrick. I too, fascinated with end times prophecy. I haven't done the kind of work and homework on it that you have. But it just is kind of marvelous to interpret, especially with the outcome, depending on how one perceives it.
Yes, definitely.
Now, you have a website out called BibleUFO.com. Pretty comprehensive. It deals a lot with the biblical UFO connection. Let's go way back, way back. Where you and von Däniken agree that there was visitation, you just don't agree on what the visitation was and the interpretation of it. Set the stage for me. How far back are we going?
Well, I believe we go back to the beginning of time.
All right.
As I'm, you know, something had to put this planet here. Something had to put it in motion around the sun and what have you. What my belief is that this planet has gone through not just one creation, but several creations. Of course, we see that in the archaeological and geological record, which the church, of course, denies. The earth has not, the entire creation as we know it, has not been around for just 6,000 years. And the date is 4004 B.C. They get it right down to a year. But we see our civilizations going back to at least 12,000. And then we have records. The Egyptians, for instance, when Herodotus visited the priests that were guarding the Great Pyramid, mm-hmm. which initially got me interested in this, and that's a fascinating story. He They trace their history back to 11,000 BC, and he asked them what happened before that, and he said, "Well, we didn't need a priesthood then. The gods were here."
Uh-huh.
Absolutely fascinating. And, of course, we have the Mayans going back millions of years. I believe there's actually, in the book of Jeremiah, a story of a previous creation prior to the one that we see in Genesis 1-1.
Michael Cremo, you're familiar with his work?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Truly believes that mankind, civilizations, go back hundreds of millions of years on this planet. And, you know, he might be right there, Patrick. We may have had, indeed, civilizations that have toppled themselves, or something has happened where they have gone extinct. But they may be that old.
Yes.
It's very,
very
possible.
I definitely agree with that concept.
Do you believe in the concept that we were seeded by beings, or that we were here on the planet? We evolved.
Well, no, I don't believe in evolution. I'm not sure what happened prior to what we know as the creation, but I refer to as the great terraforming. The basic concept is really simple. If this had been just a spoken creation by this omnipotent God that didn't need to do anything at all but just speak things into creation, why did he list it as 6 days? And, of course, we see in the Bible that 6 days can be like a thousand years, a day can be like a thousand years,
right.
Or there's another place in the Bible where a day can be 6,000 years. But I don't believe that time is really relevant to these beings. So, however it happened, it was a process. And then we see when he made Adam, well, he used something. He made him out of the dust of the earth. And then when he found he was lonely, what did he do? He took a rib from him. He didn't make her out of the dust of the earth. He literally, I believe, cloned Eve from Adam's rib. So we're talking about a highly advanced race of beings that apparently can create biospheres, and according to them, actually put the rock that they created, that biosphere, in motion around a sun that is revolving around in a galaxy which is revolving around in a universe. And it's after there are billions of planets in our galaxy. And there are billions of galaxies. What is that all about?
And there may be many multiverses now, Patrick. So it could be endless, you know?
Oh, yes. Every time, the farther we go out into the universe, the bigger it gets. The farther we can see, the bigger it gets.
Because Genesis is going to be important here tonight in your interpretation, von Däniken believes that we had humans on this planet and that they witnessed something remarkable. They witnessed beings from another planetary system, perhaps, coming down on this planet, and that the technology was so overwhelming for these human beings at the time that the sightings were just so overwhelming that they saw these people, these creatures, as gods. And for a moment here, before we get into your argument, I can understand how von Däniken would think that, because if you have a civilization here that is, you know, not highly evolved at all, and they see things come down from above, I guess you would think they were godlike, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. We have to consider the reality here. Arthur C. Clarke stated that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And you just mentioned that Michio Kaku is going to be interviewed on the show in a couple of days.
Yes.
And he was on the Peter Jennings UFO special, and he was discussing how advanced these races are. And he made a profound statement as far as I'm concerned. He said, I'm going to paraphrase it, he said that the way we look at these beings that are piloting the UFOs, you know, he is very, very much a pro-UFO person, as far as I'm concerned.
And for a physicist, that's pretty dramatic.
It's amazing. He's a theoretical physicist at, I believe it's New York State University.
Mm-hmm.
But the statement that he made was, we look at these beings as being hundreds, if not thousands of years more advanced than we are. What we really need to think about is that these beings could be millions, if not billions, of years more advanced than
we are. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And we see, not only in the ancient records and throughout our history, we see these craft that these beings are in perform some amazing things. But they just seem to be hanging out there and watching. They're not really doing anything, but don't try to catch them. And there's a lot of theories about how they appear around weapons, you know, these heavy-duty weapon systems that they're testing. We know that they disabled an entire group of nuclear missiles. But they just seem to be hanging there. But what the record shows from what they have done, and we see these incredible what are called miracles in the Bible. The Bible is loaded with miracles, and it's absolutely amazing. Not only do they seem to have a very, very highly refined and far advanced technology than we do, but they also seem to have a great deal of personal power that they exhibit as well. So they have not only, if you want to say evolved or advanced, they have not only advanced in technology, they have advanced in their own sense of being, their own reality, and who they are and the power that they possess. So von Däniken is correct. He is absolutely correct. The people were very much awed by these beings. Now, the reason that we disagree about aliens, I don't disagree that much with him. That's the one thing that we need to set straight here.
Okay, yeah, let's clarify that.
Okay, there are two types of divine beings spoken of in the Bible. The Elohim, which the very first word, the very first place where God appears in the Bible is in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. That God, that word God is taken from the Hebrew word Elohim, and it is a plural word. It means gods in the particular sense, always used as a plural. The IYM on the end of it makes it plural. Then we have the beings known as the angels, which are called the Malach in the Hebrew. And those beings seem to serve these gods, the Elohim. And what if you look at it from a perspective, an easy way for a layman to understand the way this is figured. If you look at the concepts that were in Star Wars, you have the Force, you have the Jedi, you have the Federation. Now, what I believe is it's something along those lines. The Force is the power of these beings. They seem to have a very, they've got it really under control.
They know what it's...
Everything is in balance and everything works just fine. Then you have the Jedi. Now, I believe the Jedi themselves would be considered as the gods themselves, a family of gods is the way I believe it's actually portrayed.
Okay.
And then the Federation that you see in the Star Wars concept, those are the angels. Now, there are no descriptions of any value within the Bible that describe these angels. They are described as being terrible, they're brilliant, they're this, that, and the other thing, but nothing about their general appearance except one time in the New Testament when Jesus was placed in the tomb. After the 3 days, Peter came in and he saw a youth, what he called a youth, or a small person in the tomb who told him that Jesus was gone. Now, that's the only description we have. They do not have, we don't have descriptions of them having wings, halos, playing harps, long, beautiful blonde hair, and that kind of thing. That doesn't exist. The Bible does not preclude that the angels could be the grays and the blues and the browns and the reptilian type and the mantis type. The Bible does not preclude that. Therefore, it could be that the angels are the aliens that we are seeing that are being reported in Close Encounters in our modern times.
Interesting. Okay, now, for us to get a better perspective on what we're talking about here today with your theories, tell me what you think the Elohim might be, first and foremost. If they are indeed the gods, explain that a little bit more for us.
Well, God is a generic term, a higher being. there are a lot of, apparently there is a single being at the head of this race of beings known as the Father. And this is not the God that spoke to Abraham, Isaac, Ezekiel. He is known as the Lord God. He is specific to that. There is an Almighty that is spoken of in the Bible. And apparently, this being has an incredible power to keep things working within the universe. And for some reason, he apparently decided to recreate himself. As we know, Jesus is called his son. Right. Jesus, if you look at John 1, the first chapter of John, you will see him speaking about the Word, that all things were made by the Word, and the Word became flesh and dwelt amongst us. What he is pointing out is that Jesus Christ was the God of the Old Testament, and his name was Jehovah in the Hebrew.
Right.
And you all, whenever you see the words Lord God together, that is the national God of Israel. He is the one that is speaking to the prophets. He is the one that is always involved with that. And apparently he cycled into a human and then cycled right back out. And he is described by Daniel, who saw him, and John, who saw him, in exactly the same way. So apparently he just changed into a human and then changed back into a god.
Okay, now this is not part of the Elohim, you're saying?
Yes, he is. Apparently, this Lord God, Jehovah God, who became Jesus, is the highest ranking member, the highest ranking of family members. Underneath this person in the Hebrew, he's called the Almighty. He's called Pater Father in the New Testament.
How many of them were there, do you think?
We don't have any idea. It speaks of many gods. It speaks of gods, of the Lord God standing in the council of other gods, but he's the mightiest one. There is no number. There is no number at all. The angels are numbered in the billions, or could be in the billions. It's not sure, but there's a bunch of them out there, I guarantee you that.
How did they get here, Patrick?
They flew here, apparently. It would seem to be that that's what the we see
go ahead. Not in craft, you're saying.
Yes, I believe they came in craft.
They came in craft. Okay.
Either they come in craft or they live in these craft.
Okay,
I'm not sure. They don't seem to have a central world.
To me, that sounds physical, then. If they come in craft.
Yeah, absolutely physical.
Okay. All right, so the fact that they have visited us in craft, which then they had to have built, that doesn't sound godlike to me. That sounds like a higher civilization.
Yes.
But it doesn't sound godlike, does it?
No, God, like I say, this term that we use is God. Of course, well, let's look at the God of the church, George. The God of the church is this omnipotent, invisible being that lives in heaven somewhere.
Yeah.
And apparently does most of what he does is inflict his revenge on mankind for one reason or another. He is not well defined within the church. You are not to ask what he looks like or anything like that, but let's be clear here. When he made this man Adam, what did he say? He said, "Let us make man in our image and after our likeness." Now, let's be logical here. If the gods made man to look like the gods, then the gods must look like men.
I would agree with that.
That's the important thing. So you have apparently this, the thing about the way the church approaches it doesn't have any relation to the Bible. God says very clearly.
All right, hold on, Patrick. Right. We're going to take this real quick break, and then we'll come right back. This is fascinating. Patrick, we're going back now to talk about your theories of the visitation here, and you believe they came here in craft, these gods.
Yes.
Okay. And craft that they obviously constructed?
Yes.
Okay, so is there a difference between our perception of the biblical God, okay, the creator, and these gods that visited us? Or are we talking about one and the same?
One and the same.
Okay. All right. With that, let's go on a little bit more with your theory and tell us what you think happened years ago.
Well, the one thing that we were discussing earlier is about the physical nature of this God. And I'm going to read to you a verse out of Exodus 19. It's verse 9. And then the Lord said unto Moses, Lo, I come to thee in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with thee and believe thee forever. He is stating a specific purpose for showing up in whatever this thick cloud is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, the translators, the King James translators, added all of those these in. Now, let me read to you exactly how it read in the original languages. And the Lord said unto Moses, Lo, I come in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak and believe forever. Apparently, he is stating that he is here, and that is why he is using this craft, this thick cloud. The word cloud in this situation comes from the Hebrew word which means scud cloud. Not your big, high, fluffy clouds, but the low clouds that you see scooting below in thunderstorms and things like that. Those low clouds are called scud clouds, very dark and moving very fast. And that's where that word cloud comes from. But there are all kinds of clouds in the Bible. There are rapidly what we see basically. If you look at now, I have over a thousand verses laid out in categories such as what these vehicles are, how they're described. There are clouds, thrones, pavilions, pillars, chariots, all kinds of different vehicles that are described.
Do they talk about propulsion at all, Patrick?
Not really, no. Now, we do see propulsion discussed in other writings. Now, I am a comparative theologist. I do not believe that this phenomenon is exclusive to the Hebrews. I cannot see a god or a race of highly advanced race of beings who we think of as the gods, only concentrating on less than 1% of the world's population that dwell on less than 1% of the world's landmass. Therefore, it's a whole, if you look at the similarities, that's what comparative theology is. Well, some comparative theologists look at the dissimilarities between religions being autonomous and not tied to any dogmatic belief. I can look at it the other way, the similarities. And, of course, we see that in a number of the gods around the world. There are saviors. There are virgins. It's amazing the number. There are at least a score of gods who were here from virgin birth. That includes the God of the Bible, the God of Egypt, Krishna, Muhammad, the whole nine yards. It's a complete, Vishnu, I'm a little lost here, but a number of the gods have similarities between them. I believe, after going over this for the last three decades, is that we are not what we view in the mainstream is that we have a number of different gods, all in a number of different religions. What I believe is that what we have is the same gods being described by different cultures with different traditions, different languages, living in different environments, eating different foods, dressing differently, thinking differently, different social structures, the whole nine yards. So
different,
I believe
different perception, everything.
All talking about the same God. They all experience floods. But the most important, getting down to the most important thing, the key to the whole thing is they all say the same thing. Love each other.
True.
Take care of each other. And if you do that, everything's fine. But if you don't, things get rough and we're going to have to come back and pull you out of a hole.
The God portrayed by religion, to me, comes across as very spiritual, kind of mystical. The gods portrayed by you come across as very physical. Piloting craft, for example.
Yes.
Why the difference?
Well, there's no real difference. It's all in the attitude. What you, well, I'm not saying you,
but
what the mainstream has been taught is that this God is omnipotent, all powerful, everything, knows everything that's going on everywhere, all the time, constantly, and that he's just mysterious, he's ethereal, you can't see him. And that's just not the way the Bible portrays it. Moses saw God. Job saw God. Ezekiel saw God. Daniel saw God. He has a physical presence, and of course, he stated in the verse that I just quoted, he states very clearly that he comes in a thick cloud.
Okay, you don't think, though, that there could be distinctive visitors, ET visitors to the planet from other planetary systems, and we could have this omnipotent God as well.
Two well, not omnipotent separate God, but this highly advanced and apparently most, according to it, according to this race of gods, they're the most powerful gods in the universe. But, as I stated before, I do believe there are other alien races, possibly living on other worlds, that serve these Elohim. That's where it gets a little bit confusing, because the angels are not the gods.
No.
I believe the gods travel in these craft, but I believe for the most part what we are seeing are the angels, the Malak that are described, that serve the Elohim and seem to do the grunt work, as it were.
Well, let's talk about the Greek gods for just a moment, Patrick.
Yes.
To me, I could accept that thought, because the way they describe the Greek gods in Greek mythology, they seem extraterrestrial, and they are godlike, and they're different. Each one of them seems to have a different strength.
Right.
Zeus being the father god, basically.
Right.
And then they have all these other offshoots.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense to me. You too?
Yes. Yes. It's just simply that the Bible does not describe the other gods that are mentioned. It doesn't speak to them.
No.
Why not? I don't know. I have no idea. It's not as detailed. It's more, if you'll notice, it's the entire Old Testament is mostly about the histories of the history of the Hebrews and their encounters with this God.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's basically a Hebrew-centric book. It's about the Hebrews. Now, the Bible was put together in 325 A.D. by the first theologian of the Catholic Church, known as Eusebius. He was a personal friend of the Emperor Constantine, who did the original Reformation of the Church that now has become what we know as the Christian Church. He put together a book of an Old Testament that he decided would be the Old Testament. It's believed that he took most of his things from Origen. He put these books together and printed 50 Bibles. Now, we have one of those 50 Bibles. It was just released about a year ago, I believe. And we have those Bibles. But those were not the only books that were used by the Hebrews. There were many other books. I have on my website, I deal in the lost books of the Bible as well. And I have on my website about 600 lost books, many of them linked. Now, we only accept, it's very hard. I don't have a staff or anything like that. So we have, myself and my editor, have to read these books and have to vet them, make sure there's no contradictions with the other books, make
right.
sure that they are original. But if you take those books, if you just added the book of Enoch into the Bible, you would expand it would be more like some of the other religions. And if you added other books, we accept the Shepherd of Hermas, the Book of Jasher, the Book of Enoch, the Book of Barnabas. There are a few that we have gone through. But generally, if the book was accepted by the Hebrews, and if it was prior to the 4th century A.D., we believe there's a good possibility that the book is valid. So, but the Bible is like a Reader's Digest of what is actually like picking up a Reader's Digest out of a library. That is not the whole library. There's so much more out there that we don't know about. And a lot have been lost. There are 28 other books that are described, they're quoted in the Bible. And I guess about half of those we have not been able to recover. They're just not there any longer. But there's a whole different, and when you read some of the things that are in these books, there's an experience. Enoch is a fascinating book. So there's a lot of other books out there that would make the Bible much broader and much different from the other religions, much broader and more in sync with the other religions around the world.
At any point in the Bible, do they talk directly about ETs or extraterrestrials, or is it all angelic and godlike?
Well, yes. They don't talk about other worlds. Jesus talked about having other flocks, which was interesting. But no, there's no. We have to understand. The thing is, it wasn't until 1877 when Vincent Schiaparelli, who was the chief astronomer in Milan,
right,
discovered the canals on Mars. With his telescope. Now, what was amazing about that was that the word, when it was translated from the Italian, which it was originally, his report was originally written in, the word canale, C-A-N-A-L-E, was translated into the word canal. Now, canale means a gully. Canal is a constructed waterway. Therefore, when it came into the public, all of a sudden we have intelligent life on Mars. And then 20 years later, H.G. Wells wrote the book War of the Worlds, which presented the first alien invader concept and the concept of people from another world. So they had it in their mind about there might be a civilization on Mars, and then all of a sudden H.G. Wells comes out with this and puts it into a different perspective, of course, a fictional perspective. But nonetheless, a perspective that has stuck with us. Prior to that time, for the thousands of years of written history, they were all called the gods, the sky people. It wasn't until the 16th century that the public really caught on to the fact that we even had planets in our solar system. So the concept of beings from other worlds didn't make any sense back then. It was, they just came out of the sky, is all those people know. And that's what, and of course, now here's the thing that's very important. When I first started this research, I was studying the Great Pyramid, and I wanted to, most engineers that have studied this agree that there's one big problem, and that's the fact that all of these stones were quarried up to 600 miles away on the other side of the Nile River, which is a very shallow river.
You know, it's funny, too, that you say that, Patrick, because this week I had Zahi Hawass on the program,
head of
Egypt's Antiquities, and he contends all the stones came from right next to the pyramids.
Well, he's I don't agree with a lot of
you can't argue with Zahi. You got to listen and ask him questions and let him give his side of it, because you argue with him, you'll never get anywhere.
I know. I've watched him go. I've seen his specials and things like that. But I don't have a great deal of respect for him as the director of the Department of Antiquities in Egypt. But that's just my personal opinion. But anyway, the engineers could get everything. They could use all kinds of processes to get it from the quarries to one side of the Nile. And then once they got it over the Nile, they had these ramps and all these other ideas about how they would build it. But they all agreed that flight had to be used. And, of course, at that time, I was considering that it was probably an alien race that had created it. Now, I didn't have any problems with that as a theologian, because I figured these gods, I didn't have it in proper perspective, but I knew that these, if there were aliens out there, and this God that was in the Bible, he could have created them as well. There's no problem. I didn't have any problem with that. So I started studying flight in the Bible. Of course, flight happens in the sky. It's amazing that the word sky and skies in a word in a Bible with 770,000 words, where almost everything happens outdoors, only has the word sky or skies 11 times. However, if you start looking at what the clouds and the birds and everything like that that are in the sky, when you start looking those up, you're going to find that they're not in the sky, that they're in heaven. Now, as a theologian, I had never looked up. Heaven to me was the same concept that we always had, that the mainstream holds. So I looked up that word heaven. It only comes from two words in the entire Bible, from the word shamayim in the Old Testament in Hebrew, which means the sky where the stars and the clouds are, and the word shamayin in the New Testament having exactly the same meaning. So everywhere where you see the word, and there's no description of this heavenly place. There is a description of a city that lands on the planet that has pearly gates, and that's where all that comes from. But there is no, it doesn't say you're going to go to heaven. It doesn't say that's where you're going to spend the rest of eternity. That's never said. If you take the word heaven and replace it with the word sky, the 730 times it's used in the Bible, it fits every time. Therefore, all these things, these clouds, these swift clouds, these glowing clouds, these pillars, these amazing chariots, these fiery chariots, the whirlwinds, all of these things were not happening in some other dimension, but they were happening in the sky in front of the people who were writing about them. And that's what they were describing.
Let's talk while we have a few moments, and then we'll carry into next hour, because I want to talk with you about why some UFOs have been depicted as being evil, the fallen angels and some of those areas. But
yeah,
let's talk about the angels and the aliens. You brought up something pretty fascinating earlier, Patrick, and that is the possibility that these angels could be interpreted as these alien grays. Tell me a little bit more about that.
All right. Well, the description of angels in the Bible do not reflect what the mainstream thought is. Wikipedia, for instance, describes an angel as an ethereal being found in many religions whose duties are to assist and serve God. They typically act as messengers, as believed in the three main monotheistic religions. Now, mainstream thought believes that angels are described in the Bible as having bird-like wings, soft and beautiful features, everything like that. But about the only thing that seems to be true about the description of angels is about them flying in the clouds. All the rest bears no resemblance to truth. As far as we were able to determine, the standard image of how angels appears basically is based on the imagination of painters and sculptors who first created the images we
right.
see throughout
Good
history.
Point.
And
That's
we
true.
Put heavy emphasis on the word imagination because no such descriptions are found anywhere in the Bible. What we do find is brilliant and sparkling, very terrible, warlike, and incredibly powerful angels. Some do appear as men, but there is nothing like the angelic images we see. The only description, as I said, we have of that is this little guy who was in the sepulcher. The others, Lot met some. Some have appeared, but there's no real descriptions. But also, the important thing is that almost every time they appear, they strike fear into the people that see them.
Which tells me that there could be some evil associated with them.
Not necessarily.
Right. Explain that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie with our very special guest tonight, Patrick Cook. His website, and you should go look at it, is BibleUFO.com. Okay, Patrick, let's talk about angels and then some of these potential evil UFOs. And fallen angels, are they two different categories, the angels that we're talking about and fallen angels?
Well, originally I believe they were the original ones that we are discussing. The concept of fallen angels as portrayed by many theorists is covered in my research on the website in a section called Fallen Angels and UFOs, A Maze of Misconception. It's very complicated, but it's very easy to understand. In a nutshell, it all goes back to the Great Flood in Genesis 6, where we find this strange event. And it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and the daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bear children to them, the same became mighty men, which were of old men of renown. Now, they're speaking of giants, very giant beings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this description, we find the angels mating with women giving birth to giant hybrid beings, which agrees with the Bible description that I just read. The common word that is used for fallen angels, I'm sure you're familiar with Zachariah Sitchin's work.
Absolutely.
And you know how he uses the term the ones who fell from the sky or the mm-hmm. fallen ones. The common word is Nephilim, which is incorrectly taken from the word that was translated into giants in the verse that I just read. Now, any Hebrew lexicon or dictionary will show the meaning for the word giant used in that verse is Nephil, and the Hebrew meaning of that word is not the fallen ones. It is a feller, a bully, or a tyrant. Not the fallen ones, not the ones who fell from the sky. Now, a more detailed description. You notice that the Bible is very short and just describes that, and then all of a sudden a great flood happened.
Exactly.
Well, the same event is described only briefly. That is described only briefly in Genesis. It's described in detail over many chapters in the book of Enoch. Now, Enoch was a book that was used by the Hebrews. It is actually quoted in the Bible. Enoch was abducted, an amazing thing. It literally says that Enoch walked with God, and God took him, and he never came back. It was absolutely amazing. Now, what Enoch says is that these angels, it covers many chapters, so I'm just going to paraphrase what he said.
Okay, sure thing.
Enoch says that these angels conspired. They're named. There were six at the top and 200 that got together on this conspiracy. They were called the Watchers. They did not come to this planet. They were on the planet. They were already here. They taught man a lot of things. There's a whole description of what they taught mankind when they were here. He says that these giants that were born to, he does agree with the giant, that they were giant beings. First, they ate their parents out of house and home. Then they went out and ate everything they could find in the wild.
I thought you were going to say they're going to eat their parents, too.
Well, they returned and began to eat the humans.
Oh, my.
And then began to kill and eat each other. Now, this is described exactly this way in Enoch. Now, he says that God imprisoned the offending angels. You've heard the word Azazel.
Yeah.
And Samazan and a number of different angels that you hear that you hear bandied about. But these were the angels. Those were the chief angels in this conspiracy. And it says he imprisoned the offending angels in a desert prison in a place called Duadel. Now, wherever that is, I don't want to be anywhere close to it.
I don't blame
until the judgment day, which won't occur until after the second coming. And then God flooded the earth to kill those giants. Now, as an aside to all this, Enoch describes that the spirits, the angelic part of the giants, survived to become the demons or devils so prominent in New Testament description. Now, there is no biblical connection to Satan and the angels of the flood.
No.
That's one very clear thing. These are two different groups. And what's amazing about it's very detailed. I have to read a lot of scripture to you to explain it. But the great battle in heaven that everybody thinks happens at the end of the end actually is told in context of happening at the birth of Jesus Christ. It states that Satan was going to kill the baby, Jesus, and that God snatched him and his mother out and took them into a place of safety. Now, we know that Jesus was taken to Egypt for about 4 years after he was immediately taken to Egypt out of Israel because Herod was after him and had given an order to kill all the young males.
The first male of each family, right?
Right. So he was taken to a place of safety. Now, if you read, this is in, I believe it's Revelation 12. I'm not exactly sure the context. But that is when Michael attacked Satan in the sky, or in heaven, as it's written, but heaven means the sky in that context, that Satan was defeated and that he was banished out of the sky and condemned to walk on the earth. And he is going about wreaking havoc. That's basically what the book says. So the concept of fallen angels does not apply to that, to the Nephilim at all. The true fallen angels, the ones that actually did fall from the sky, according to my research, fell from the sky about 2,000 years ago.
Now, your research, are there contradictions that would refute some of the things that you've done?
Contradictions from what standpoint?
In terms of your approach that they were godlike as opposed to ET visitors.
Well, that's not really a contradiction. Again, we have to deal with the concept that there are two separate types of beings. The Malak, which I believe very easily could be a whole federation of different races of angels. And then, of course, in the modern sightings and close encounters that we see, we have everything, a wide variety. We have Nordics, we have grays, we have blues, we have browns. And it goes on and on, a number of different descriptions that people describe. That could literally be, and of course, the different types and sizes of craft that we see, there's an amazing array of those. What is to say that those are not different races from different parts of the galaxy or the universe?
Good point.
That are working for the Elohim, and that's why we see this great variety around. And again, I say there is nothing in the Bible to preclude that particular idea. Nothing contradicts that idea in the Bible.
Why can't we get to or find, then, the great creator, the one? Is there one somewhere out there?
Well, according to the Bible, it's the individual, the great God, the Almighty. But he lives in what is called, according to the research that we've done, in a place called a seventh heaven. But
to me, that sounds dimensional.
You have to go to very far lengths to get to that point.
And could that be universal or another dimension?
I believe that is physically here somewhere in the universe. I don't know exactly where, but I don't see anything ethereal about these gods. I see they have a power that they project, but I don't see anything ethereal about them.
David Jacob.
On my website, I have a section called The Reality of God, and it lays out very clearly how he is described, physically described, by a number of biblical patriarchs. And there's no question about it that John gave a very clear description of him. He said he had red skin, white hair, glowing eyes. He had the sound of many wonders. He talked about a gold breastplate across his chest. He talked about his feet. He talked about, hair, feet, head. This being, it looks, is humanoid. Although not completely humanoid. He doesn't look exactly like humans, but he's got all the contraptions that go with it.
Patrick, David Jacobs believes that these ET visitations are dangerous, that they're up to something.
Yes.
Would you agree with that, even though you believe that these are God visitations primarily?
Well, in the first place, there can be no doubt that the gods as described in the Bible are not cute and cuddly. As you can see from the plagues that were inflicted on Egypt, the bombings of Sodom and Gomorrah, and other instances in the Bible. But in our modern world, there's very little and certainly no solid evidence that the intentions of these beings are malevolent toward mankind. There are a lot of speculators, a lot of theorists who claim this. And I've heard everything from E.T. sitting in front of a bunch of generals in a suit all the way to, brain-eating, baby-stealing, the David Icke concept, the Sherry Schreiner concept, all of that. There's a whole slew of people out there doing it. But if you look at the actual close encounters themselves, the the reports of bad experiences are minuscule compared to the number of overwhelmingly positive. Now, I have been, of course, I attract that kind of attention with my website, and I've been at this for 10 years. And I've received thousands and thousands of emails. I have never received an email from anybody who claimed they had a bad experience with a UFO, but I have received an overwhelming number of people who say they have had positive experiences.
Positive.
Theopany, I believe it's called, where they get their whole life changes around them, and they basically feel an affinity with these beings. Of course, now, if you think, just imagine, George, if you were abducted, thrown into a trunk of a car, and driven to a country house somewhere, and thrown into a room, you would be incredibly traumatized. But imagine you can hear the sound of the car,
mm-hmm.
and you can hear voices around you, and you can smell things that you're familiar with. But imagine if you're taken into a place where no human goes, and you've got beings that don't look like humans, you've got surroundings that don't look like anything you've ever seen, you've got sights and sounds that you've never experienced,
yeah.
imagine the trauma that goes with that. There
Absolutely.
Is no question that the abduction phenomena is traumatic. But Enoch, Moses, Elijah, Samuel, Ezekiel, Philip, and even Jesus himself experienced what we describe as divine abductions. And as I said, Enoch and Elijah himself never came back. But what I believe, of course, there are literally thousands of websites and authors that will dispute this, many of whom I'm sure you've interviewed. But we think that the jury is still a long way out from proving that they are evil. They can speculate all they want to. But I don't know. The only way it's going to be solved is if what I'm saying is true and they're coming. Then we'll find out, won't we?
When, I've got to ask you this, it's not off the path entirely, but when Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed,
yes.
Lot's wife turned around, she turned into a pillar of salt. Do you think she was witnessing some kind of nuclear explosion?
Oh, well, of course it wouldn't have been nuclear, because we'd certainly detect high levels of radiation even after all these years in that area. And that is not the case. What it says is that fire and brimstone came down from heaven. We see things like this. We see fire coming down from these craft that crawls along the ground, something strange. Well, we have to realize that when they're speaking of these things, remember, they had no technology. They had no lights. They had no the wheel was a brand new thing.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have kites. They didn't have balloons. They didn't have, nothing was in the sky but birds and clouds and stars and the sun and the moon. And so you're talking about a primitive people. When they say the word fire and brimstone, that's the only thing they talk about, coals of fire. But could these be advanced weapons? Now, when we talk about nuclear explosions, and I've been dealing, of course, with this for years, I don't think that beings that are this far advanced would even be dealing with something as primitive and destructive and so mass destructive as a nuclear weapon. I believe that these were high-tech weapons that they were using. And I don't know what it was, and I would love for somebody to explain to me what happened to her, but if it had happened just because their back was turned doesn't mean that it wouldn't happen to them as well, and she was with them.
Exactly.
So why did her turning around cause that? That was the action that caused her, and they were warned not to turn around and look. It had to do with the looking. I don't know what that's about, but that's a fascinating concept.
Yeah. And I don't think she turned into a pillar of salt. I think she probably just was disintegrated.
Well, I don't know exactly what that means. I've translated those words, and it appears to be that that's what the description was, but we can't tell for sure.
You do a lot of things different on your website. It's not just biblical UFOs. You really dive into the paranormal, don't you?
Oh, yes.
That's why we're going to ask you some other questions later.
All right.
Tell us a little bit, though, about your work with the biblical cryptozoology.
Oh, that's a fascinating subject.
It really is.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me see here.
You know, you talk about giants and dragons.
Yes, I have probably one of the most extensive, next to Stephen Quayle, I've probably got one of the most extensive collections of giants. Of course, we talked about giants. Apparently, that stayed in the gene pool after the flood, because we see giants in the Bible. There's giants in the Bible. But, you know, amazingly, I do a lot of theological work, and I'm very much, you know, I'm going after the 2-billion-member church. I go after corporations. I go after the UFO, a great deal of the people in the UFO community. But surprisingly, cryptozoology is my favorite subject. I really love it.
Now, when you say you go after them, they come right back at you?
Not really. No, it's absolutely amazing. You know, when I first started this, George, I thought that I would get a great deal of flack. Amazingly, over the years, my email and my responses from other people have been 10-to-1 positive. It's amazing. I don't know why, because I just presumed that I was, and I am completely outnumbered out there. There's very few people, David Twitchell, Barry Downing, a few other people that follow this, but they all have their different concepts.
True.
But I'm the one that sticks to the concept that there aren't any evil UFOs. I don't believe that these gods being this powerful, or these beings, let's sort of move away from the word God, this race of beings being so powerful, would allow other entities that weren't, didn't have the best interest of mankind at heart to come into this.
You would think that they'd be so advanced that they would be beyond where we are today.
Yes, and that's the point. You know, we have the Star Wars concepts, we have this, the all kinds of evil aliens portrayed, Independence Day, the whole nine yards. But yes, George, I agree with you 100%. Why would, you know, we're learning a very valuable lesson with what we're doing here on this planet. And we've got to turn around. One, either we're going to do it on our own or we're going to be forced to do it. And that, I believe we're going to be forced to do it, because I think we've already screwed it up so big that we're not going to be able to turn the clock back.
Right.
But let's say, hypothetically, that we do continue on. I certainly do believe, and you see the movement. You see it here in this country right now, people coming together. I think eventually we'd get back to community. We'd get back to commons. We'd get back to taking care of one another. And then eventually, I mean, it doesn't take too long to know that if you beat your head against a wall, it hurts.
We'll be back with biblical cryptozoology, end times prophecy. How about ghosts in the Bible? That's all next on Coast to Coast AM. Patrick, biblical cryptozoology. Let's talk about some of the creatures that were around then.
Well, there's an amazing number. The hold on just a second.
Okay.
I'm having just a little bit of a problem here. In the Bible, there are giants, dragons, unicorns, behemoths, satyrs, cockatrices, flying fiery serpents, and a gigantic, terrifying, fire-breathing, smoke-snorting, indestructible amphibious sea monster.
Jeez.
It's absolutely amazing. We have an entire section called the Biblical Bestiary. It's not as complete as I would like it. But there's no question that there are a number of different types of animals that don't seem to make sense insofar as the concept of the Bible goes. Now, one of the most fascinating things in the Bible are the dragons.
How so?
Well, there are over 20 references to dragons in the Bible. Job 30:29. Now, this is interesting. I want you to think of this in context.
Okay.
I am brother to dragons and a companion to owls. Now, he's talking about dragons as though they were natural creatures.
Right, right.
In Deuteronomy 32, it says their wine is the poison of dragons. In Nehemiah 2:13, it says, "And I went out by the night by the gate of the valley, even before the dragon well." In Psalms, we read that thou hast sore broken us in the place of dragons. There are a number of references, but the important thing is that, dragons not only appear in the Bible, but dragons seem to have a quite a place in our historical reality.
What happened to them?
Well, we don't know. Your namesake, St. George, there's a famous legend about St. George and the dragon, basically that a dragon made its nest in the spring that provided water for a city called Lydda in Judea, and the citizens had to dislodge the dragon from its nest for a time in order to collect water. And to do so, each day they had to offer the dragon a sheep, and if no sheep could be found, then a maiden instead of the sheep. Now, the victim was chosen by lots, and one day this happened to be a princess, and the monarch was begging for her life with no result. She was offered to the dragon, and then all of a sudden, St. George rides up and slays the dragon. We have Eastern dragons. The Eastern dragons, such as the Chinese dragons, one is called Lung. He's a divine bringer of rain. In the I Ching, which means the Book of Change, it uses the symbolism of dragon to illuminate truths. There's a Vietnamese dragon called Long. There's another Vietnamese dragon called Gai Long. Hanoi was once known as the Dragon City. We have Western dragons. The British Isles, in the British Isles, there are dozens of dragon caves and dragon-haunted locks. Scotland has its share, the Wiltshire Dragon, the Dragon of Losky Hill, the Dragon of Knucker Hole. Germany has their dragons. Beowulf, in their legends, had three separate battles with dragons. They have a dragon of the north. There are the fire drakes. Even in little tiny Iceland, the god Loki has associations with a female dragon. And I have a list with the names of almost 1,000 dragons, the named dragons around the world. Now, the important thing that we have to consider here is the difference between myth and legend. Myth is something basically that comes from an unsubstantiated source and has no verifiable reality. But legend is also a little bit shaky, but
right,
has...
But generally handed down, almost like from father to witness, from witness to...
Right. It's more of a historical content. And I believe that dragons are legendary rather than mythical. Unicorns are another perfect example of that.
Right.
Now, let's talk about the unicorn. A lot of people, let's take a brief view of how unicorns are viewed. There are thousands of pictures of them and thousands of little statues, and I've got one myself. They're very cute. This little horse with a cutesy little...
single
horn and you know, all fluffy and everything like that, and usually with a maiden and the whole nine yards. Now, what I'm going to do to read, I'm going to read to you is the first is I'm going to read Job 39:5-8, getting to this point. Who sent out the wild ass free, or who has loosed the bands of the wild ass? He's talking about goats here. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. Now, in verse 9. We see this. Will the unicorn be willing to serve you or abide in your crib? Can you bind the unicorn with his band in a furrow? Or will he harrow the valleys after you? Will he plow the valleys after you? Will you trust him because his strength is great? Or will you leave labor to him? Will you believe him? Or will you bring him home? Will he bring home your seed and gather it into your barn? This is not a cutesy little animal. The concept of great strength, you can't control him. You can't use him as a domestic animal. And you see all kinds of verses. Now that's 9 through 12. In verse 13, gave thou the goodly wings unto the peacocks, or the wings and feathers unto the ostrich. Now, what we're seeing here is a unicorn, and this comes from the word Rahim in the Hebrew. You see, first he's talking about goats, then he talks about unicorns, and then he talks about peacocks. So this is a natural accepted animal. But in Numbers 23:22, we see God brought them out of Egypt. He hath, as it were, the strength of a unicorn. Now, they're talking specifically about the strength of this animal. Deuteronomy talks about the horns of the unicorn. Psalms 92 talks about the horns of the unicorn. And in Psalm 74, we see, thou hast divided the sea by thy strength, thou hast breakest the heads of the... that was another verse.
But these creatures, Patrick, are almost as prevalent as discussions of angels and gods.
Yes. It,
truly amazing.
Yes. And now we see unicorns in history. We've got Julius Caesar saw a unicorn. Alexander the Great saw a unicorn. Genghis Khan stopped his attack on India because he experienced a unicorn. They are throughout history. They're in Chinese culture. They're in European culture. They're everywhere. So what we see is positive. Now, you ask what might have killed the dragon. Well, it could have been the dragons themselves. It could be the fact that they were so obtrusive in their nature that they were killed. Unicorns, I certainly believe, if my research is correct, that unicorns died for their horns. I believe they were taken to extinction from their horns. They were highly prized. And there's an amazing story. Now, this is of the unicorn in Persia called Shathatvar. Was described as a creature that looked somewhat like an antelope, yet with a single horn on its forehead. This horn had hollow ends which created the most beautiful and tempting melodies when the wind was blowing through them. Other animals who heard these melodies were lured out of their hiding places by the sound and killed by the Shathatvar at the very moment they had come too near it. So I believe that if there were unicorns, now of course, we don't have any unicorn horns, we don't have any unicorn skeletons, but it's Alexander the Great supposedly rode one, and when he was able to tame it, his father said that nothing would stop, that the entire empire could not contain him. So these are animals of great strength. If you look at anybody, just type in unicorns into a search engine, and you're going to have to look pretty deep, but you'll find it. It's amazing what these creatures were. Alexander the Great ran into one when he was on one of his crusades. They are described as the one that Julius Caesar described, I believe, is 18 feet tall. The one that Alexander described was 16 feet tall and scared his troops so badly that they had to get out of there because the horses were extremely agitated because of the presence of this animal, and he called it a reem. And I believe that was the last known sighting of one of these animals. Apparently, it's huge. It's like an ox. It weighs thousands of pounds. And you can imagine something 16 foot tall. That's almost as big as a two-story house.
Let's move on to the ghosts in the Bibles, if we can, Patrick, because all of this is just amazing research that you've done. Tell me about what you were able to discover in this arena.
Okay, well, hold on just a second.
I shall do that. And then, of course, we'll get into one of your favorite subjects, end-time prophecies, as
right.
Well. And I want to get your take if you believe we are in the end times right now and what that all means at the end. But there were, in biblical recollections, demons. They talk about Satan. But they did seem to allude that there are ghosts, that they exist.
Okay, well, I'm going to prove it positively here.
All right.
Ghosts are generally classified as evil by the mainstream Christian thought, as you know. Yet it seems to be dealt with as a natural event in the course of human experience in the Bible. Death itself is described as giving up the ghost. Abraham gave up the ghost. and so on and so forth. Now, I want you to think about this. This is no stretch. It is no stretch of the imagination to consider this biblical event as a classic description of an encounter with a ghost, which anyone would recognize. This is from Job. This is out of the King James Bible, Job 4:14, verses 14 through 17. Now listen to this. Fear came upon me and trembling, which made all my bones to shake. Then a spirit passed before my face. The hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern the form thereof. An image was before my eyes. There was silence, and I heard a voice saying, "Shall mortal man be more than just God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker?" Now you tell me, does that sound like an encounter with a ghost? There's no evil associated with this apparition, and it actually seems to be imparting wisdom to Job. Now what I want to do here is I'm going to read to you probably something that most people have never heard, and this is a verse that was written by David, and it is the only description of what happens after death in the Bible. Now listen to this. The days of our years are 70 years, or 70.
70.
And if by reason of strength they be 80 years, or 80, yet in their strength labor and sorrow. You know, you have labor and sorrow during your life, but it is soon cut off. Now the last four words of this are absolutely amazing, and I have checked this in every context possible. The last four words are, "And we fly away."
We fly away.
That comes right out of the King James Bible. You will never hear that in church. But I want you to think about this. Let's just move real quick to one of the strange human anomalies that are experienced constantly, called near-death experiences. What happens when they die? They rise up. It's always the same thing. They rise up to the ceiling and then beyond the ceiling. But they can see themselves down on the bed. And there's actually research. I don't know whether you're familiar with this now. But there's research, legitimate scientific research, to study near-death experiences.
Right.
And they're putting paintings on the floor, because they know that people rise up. Well, that's flying. And then what other phenomena do we have in the paranormal world of human anomalies? OBEs, out-of-body experiences.
Which is very close to dying. Very close,
yes,
isn't it?
Very close to dying. And what happens? Well, we seem to have the spiritual ability, whatever that is, that flies away, because we know the body stays here. But now I've given you absolute proof in the Bible that a Christian, you've never heard in a Christian church, that in fact what happens after death is that you fly away. It doesn't say where you fly, but we hear in near-death experiences that they fly to a light. They meet people on the other side, and the ones who do come back, well, of course, are the only ones we hear about. The ones that do come back say that they were sent back. But
why weren't we taught this when we were
Well,
younger?
Why weren't we taught a lot of things? I mean, you know, we've got this hell. You know, hell, we've got fear and incentive motivation within the church.
That's control, isn't it?
If you don't do it, you're going to go to hell, and this God is going to throw you into a lake of fire. You're going to be pricked with pitchforks. You're going to be burning, and this is going to happen to you forever and ever and ever, but God loves you. Strange concepts there. And then you've got this heaven, which I've already, and you'll have to go to my website. I've got a thing called Heaven is the Sky. Or heaven not required, basically. And so the other alternative is this divine retirement home where you get to lay around and, you know, I've heard about it in 1,000 jokes, playing football or playing golf or something in this divine retirement home. But that's not what the Bible says happened to you after you die. It says you fly away. You're gone. Now, that's amazing. And then you connect that with near-death experiences, And we've just crossed a threshold that most people have never even considered.
Well, that's true. That's dramatic indeed. Are you still interpreting the Bible? Are you still looking for clues and signs?
Oh, absolutely. And what's amazing about it, this is only 66 words with 770,000 words. But I swear we continually run into things. I've got a database. What you find on my – I have 3,000 pages on that website. I only have one-tenth of our research on that website. I could use a crew of 20 people for the next 5 years just to get what I've got in my database onto that website.
You know, when you were talking earlier about UFOs arriving in clouds or the ETs or the gods, were the clouds the craft or were the clouds hiding the craft?
No, I believe the clouds were the craft.
They look like clouds, I guess.
Yes, they definitely look like clouds.
All right.
There's the whole point is that as I stated, he said he flies in a thick cloud so that the people will listen to him. But you've got basically, let me explain what if you cover my research as a whole, this is what you're going to find. That these divine beings, the God and the angels, fly in rapidly flying, glowing, spinning, in Ezekiel, they're described as metallic craft that ascend and descend, hover for long periods of time. They are dark like clouds during the day and bright and lit up at night. People and other beings are seen descending from them and ascending up to them, and they seem to violate natural. They seem to be able to conquer natural laws. We see the same thing throughout history, and we see the same thing in our modern skies right now.
And that, remember Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
Absolutely,
How they kind of rumbled in with the clouds.
Yes. Oh, well, now, I believe that does happen. That phenomenon is described often insofar as that goes. But are they there are all kinds of theories about how these things propel themselves. So there's no question about it. But are they coming down through the clouds? Are they creating the clouds themselves?
Well, that's a good point. Patrick, let's talk about end times prophecy when we come back and take phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Patrick, what is your concept of the end times prophecies of Revelation?
Well, the most popular belief is that the Revelation is the future story of the rise of an Antichrist, the world power, his actions to demand loyalty by forcing everybody to have the number 666 tattooed on their hands, the creation of a world government and world religion, the rebuilding of the temple at Jerusalem, the rapture of all good Christians, a great battle at Armageddon, thought to be the final battle that defeats Satan, the earth being destroyed by fire, and a new earth being created. Now, of all those, only the great battle at Armageddon, which is not a battle between Jesus and Satan, but actually a battle between the armies of mankind against Jesus, that is the only thing that is supported in Scripture. There is mention of a global financial control by the great merchants of earth using some kind of device to control worldwide trade, but no world government. The individual nations clearly still exist. There is no uniting of the world's religions and no mention of a new temple being constructed in Jerusalem. The word Antichrist does not even appear in the Revelation, nor does any description of any individual controlling the world. Now, what we have to understand about this, these concepts that are found in most all end-time scenarios, including the wildly popular Left Behind series, are taken from a strange theological practice known as dual prophecy. In simple terms, it means taking prophecies mainly out of the Old Testament that have already been fulfilled about past events with no regard to the context in which they appear, applying them to end times events and claiming that they have a dual meaning. Now, if you take the mishmash that they use to come up with all these things, you'll find some of these things, but prophecies that have already been fulfilled. Now, of course, they don't use all prophecies as dual. but only use those that fit their chosen agenda. For instance, they don't claim that there is a second coming, there's going to be a second birth of Christ. What the Revelation does describe is tremendous environmental upheaval, which we see in its infant stage, and a time of great pressure on world society, which is now rising at a disturbing rate. It speaks to economic control over all the people on the earth by financial giants, something we see as a growing problem today, and a great deception being committed by the great merchants of the world on all nations. And who would disagree that global corporations are deceiving the world with their rhetoric? The Revelation describes angels warning mankind of coming disasters and the rejection of the return Jesus by the masses, even though two incredibly powerful witnesses also warn mankind of its coming doom for years. They are ignored, eventually killed for their efforts. And most shockingly, it tells of false prophets leading mankind to unite and battle against the returning Jesus with an army of hundreds of millions. It does not speak of a new earth until 1,000 years after the reign of Jesus, something that the end-time theorists completely ignore, and that city, supposedly heaven, with the pearly gates is actually described as a huge, shining, golden structure with a base area of almost 2 million square miles that is not from some other dimension, but actually lands on the planet. Gives a whole new meaning to the term heaven on earth. That is what the Revelation is talking about.
Very good. And we'll talk a little bit more, but let's take some calls now. Rick, sure. West Columbia, South Carolina, is our first-time caller. Go ahead, Rick. You're on with Patrick Cook.
Yes, sir. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Great. Good. Thank you, Rick.
All right. I've had so many encounters with demons, Satan. I've seen a ghost before. Walked in the room and just said, weirdly enough, it just said, "You're good looking." And I said, "You're good looking too." And it walked right out of the room. But I've seen the Holy Spirit about three or four times in my life. I've seen an angel. I've seen.
Every time you see these, Rick, is some event occurring in your life?
When it first started, I was like, 26 years old. I'm 49 now. I was 26 years old. I stayed in this, like, the people said it was haunted house, but I didn't have any place to stay, and I didn't have but enough rent money to stay there, so I didn't believe in haunted then, so I stayed there, and sure enough, it was haunted, and the next, you know, some weird stuff happened to me there, some sexual nature stuff, and, like, toward the end of the stay there, the Holy Spirit appeared to me and just comforted me, just seeing him kind of comfort me where I wasn't scared anymore. So I guess that's why.
All right. Patrick, what about visitations like that?
Well, it depends on what we're dealing with. Unfortunately, in the up and coming ghost hunting paranormal field, there's very little distinction made between apparitions, demons, and poltergeists. They all seem to be lumped into the same category. Now, I believe that all three do exist. Of course, I just read a very stirring account about a ghost that Job encountered. But demons themselves are a different entity. I had the fortunate experience of going to see the movie The Exorcist with a former Jesuit exorcist priest. And he had to leave during the performance, but he demanded that I stay because he wanted to discuss it with me afterwards. He couldn't handle what he was seeing.
That's why he left?
Yes, that's why he left. He was. What they did is what you saw, the story actually happened to a young boy. But not all the things you see happening in that movie happened to the boy. But what they did was they took a broad range of things that are known to exist in exorcisms or demon possessions, the worst case scenario in those, and that's what you saw. In other words, you saw what priest testified to. And you've got to accept their testimony on those things. That those things really happen. Now, if you survive an attack on a demon, you're going to end up in the hospital. I have heard some stories from Jesuit priests about what these beings are capable of doing. And, of course, we see in the Bible the same thing occurring. We see a man that was so possessed by demons, he lived in the tombs, and they tried to chain this guy down, and they couldn't chain him down. And eventually Jesus did exorcise the demons into a herd of swine who committed suicide, a very Jeez. Strange story in itself.
Yeah.
But I do believe demons exist, but they're very dangerous. Now, what I hear, I constantly hear ghost hunting shows. I keep on top of everything that's going around. I doubt very seriously if any of these people are actually dealing with true demons. It's too clean. I believe they're dealing with apparitions, but of course, there's a lot of drama that goes on in these ghost hunting things, but you see very little. Where's the beef? It's not quite there. It's interesting to. I know the spiritual world exists. I know poltergeists exist. What they're doing is they're in an area that they don't really understand. This is a spiritual thing. This seems to be a multidimensional thing, and the Bible does speak to another dimension. It says that the things that we see are temporal. It's a Greek word that actually means like a prop on a stage, but the things that we don't see are eternal. So there's obviously some spiritual world. Now, that's this thing about what happens when we die, when we fly. Well, there could be a possibility that something happens, that there's a glitch in the transfer, or that they get lost or something. I don't know what it is, but ghosts definitely exist. Now, hauntings are real. You were talking about an incredible thing last night, Resurrection Mary.
Oh, yeah.
That's an absolutely fascinating thing. And so those things do exist. There's no question about it. They seem to be caught in some kind of limbo between the physical and this invisible world that is spoken of in the Bible. They seem to be caught in between those two, and I don't know what that is. I can't explain it. But ghosts, as a general rule, are not harmful. I don't hear of a lot of serious damage that happens. But when you start delving into a realm where these spirits are, I think personally, I don't think it's proper. If nothing else but respect for the dead. But if you start delving into a world that you don't understand, and you're a puny little human, and these beings are sort of caught in a netherworld here, anything that happens, any experiences that you have, I think you're basically asking for trouble. If you go out looking for these things, the only account, the witch at Endor, when Saul asked the witch, the woman who's called the witch in Endor, to conjure up Samuel, well, as soon as Samuel was conjured up, he complained about being disturbed. So apparently there's something he had to get caught back into the world that he didn't want to be in. So there seems to be a lot of agitation in that world. There seems to be a lot of problems, a lot of frustration. But I don't understand the concept of going out and looking for these things. I know in a lot of situations in cities around the world, there are buildings that are simply shut down. They will not allow anybody in there. We've got a house right here in Berkeley, California, that belonged to an underground group in the 60s that has never been occupied. Nobody will buy that house. Nobody will go into that house.
Yeah, I don't blame them.
Beg your pardon?
I don't blame them.
Yeah. The American Psychological Association, Parapsychological Association, explains these hauntings. And, you know, I've been in, there's strange things around. I worked in theater as a technician for 20 years. And in almost every stage I've ever been behind, you'll see the actors all gathering in one place. It's called the cold spot.
Yeah,
and they
that's
seem
right.
to be existing there. We've got all this strange stuff. Well, instead of, you know, they're trying to prove it's there, well, we know they're there. If you walk into a spot on the floor and it's cold, it's cold. It's that simple. But I think that personally, My personal belief is it's better left alone.
West of the Rockies, let's go to Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Nick, go ahead.
Hi, excellent show tonight. Well, I get a kick out of, I'm really getting tired of these people that say that these alien, these crap that we're seeing, that they must be evil, they must be doing nasty things to us, considering some of the history that we have of how we treated some of the other life forms on this planet. That we have laboratories all across this world with chimpanzees and monkeys that were not asking for any kind of that were just going on about their daily business out in the Amazon somewhere, and some human beings came along and abducted them, and they had to live the rest of their lives in a laboratory undergoing cruel, sadistic, inhumane treatment. Sometimes being driven to the point of insanity, bashing their head against the side of the cage until they die because human beings did that. We have Japan that every year goes out and harpoons and whales that are just swimming along doing their own business innocently, and so that somebody in New York or L.A. can eat a piece of whale meat. And I just get a kick out of people like that. That the way I look at things is that it's not the UFOs that are evil. The most evil thing that I can think of is human beings at this point. All you really have to do is watch the news and see some of the evil, destructive things that human beings are doing. It's not them, it's us. I mean, we need to change our ways before we can even complain that. If you compare the two, I do not see any comparison that some of the things that we do to the animals on this planet,
Well, Patrick, I think you'd agree with this.
Oh, yes. Well, that's a very, very interesting perspective. I've never quite thought of it that way. But, yes, I agree with you completely. Insofar as the abduction scenario goes, I definitely believe that abductions occur. But there are a specific sequence of events that happen during UFO abductions. You've got the capture. The abductee is taken from terrestrial surroundings to an apparent alien craft. They are examined. They have a conference, usually. Now, not all these things occur, but these are the general things that occur. The abductors speak to the abductee. They're given a tour of the vessel that they've been brought onto. There seems to be a loss of time. They return. They return to Earth occasionally in different locations, and it seems to be in different times. And, of course, the Bible talks about a very strange difference between the human concept of time and these beings. Theophany, which is the abductee, has a profound mystical experience, accompanied by feelings of oneness with God or the universe. And then, of course, they have to deal with the psychological ramifications of what just happened to them. What just happened to me? That's a very strange thing. And, of course, all of this is very traumatic. But it doesn't show specific intent. I've heard people, one of the things that I heard today, actually, listening to something on abductions, was that they just don't know what's going on. And some seem to have multiple abductions. They don't know why it's happening, but they don't feel that these beings have a malice toward them. It's very scary what happens, and you hear those descriptions on UFO shows, but how actually it's traumatic to a human being, but how evil is it? Let's put it that way. And why are they doing these things? Possibly for the same reason that we see bovine excisions or cattle mutilations. There seems to be a lot of scientific experimentation on them, but of course they don't cut out the soft organs of human beings.
At least we don't think they do.
Yes, we don't think they do, but I've heard of a number of things about the human mutilations and about very evil things that have happened, but I've never seen, there is no solid evidence to back this up. And of course, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but I certainly don't see the logic to it. If they wanted to control us, they don't have to knock on the door. They can, they've got power that we can't even imagine. I don't think they're here to harm us. I think they're here watching us and waiting for the inevitable destruction to happen.
All right, let's go to Nick in Vancouver. Well, we just had Nick. Let's go to east of the Rockies, Danny in Kingsland, Georgia. Go ahead.
Yes, gentlemen. Outstanding show tonight.
Thank you.
But my comment or question is about the angel that guards the Garden of Eden and his flaming sword that points like multidirectional. If that could be some type of
right.
weaponry of some type of security system, like of modern day, like maybe something similar to a nuke.
Well, what you're speaking of is called a cherubim. Now, I have a section on my website called The Beings that are associated with this whole scenario. And the cherubim, if you look at it very closely, don't appear to be humans. If they are described in so many ways. God is said to fly in a cherubim. There are cherubim on the altar, I mean, on the Ark of the Covenant. There are cherubim doing a number of things, but they don't seem to have any personality. I believe that cherubim, surprisingly enough, is a generic word in the Bible for device. And this device was set up, or this cherubim was set up in the middle of the garden with a sword, a glowing sword that pointed in all directions so that nobody could get into the garden.
We're going to come right back, Patrick. We're going to take final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Patrick, what do you think the future of mankind may be?
Well, I believe it's very hopeful after a very traumatic period. We see the planet slipping very quickly into a place where we may not be able to survive. And I believe we're going to go through a lot of trauma. We see in the prophecies, especially in Matthew 24, of famines, pestilences, earthquakes, all kinds, all manner of disasters happening to humankind. And then just when it gets to the point where we can no longer survive, that's when these beings that I speak of, the Elohim, will step in. And after a struggle with humanity, will the thing that most people don't realize, everybody thinks we're going to heaven, but what it says, if we're going to be with Jesus, as they claim, it says that he will rule the nations with a rod of iron for 1,000 years on this planet. So we have to consider that what they're talking about is a whole new world government control with Jesus at the helm. And then we ask ourselves, well, what would Jesus do? What do we see him doing during his ministry? We see him feeding people. We see him healing people. We see people changing their lives and showing great happiness. If we want to know what the world is going to be like, we need to look at the teachings of Jesus and what he did, because the Bible says that he's going to be in control, and most of the world's religions also say that the same thing is going to happen, where their God is going to be in control, and mankind will head toward a much more prosperous and progressive future. Imagine if we all just got along, if we all started taking care of one another, if we started using more healthy practices in our lives, if we started ending the wars, if we ended the wars, if we stopped the pollution, we would be a lot happier people. If we got away from the technological world and back down to our roots like we had in this country, where 90% of the people were involved in the agricultural business, I think that's what we need, and I think that's exactly what's going to happen.
To the phones we go now, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Steve, go ahead. You're on Coast to Coast.
Good evening, gentlemen. Very interesting show tonight. I just wanted to point out to Mr. Cook, I belong to a church that I'm sure you've heard of that teaches many of the concepts that you've been discussing tonight, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Yes.
Nothing related to the UFOs, but just what you've been talking about in terms of a corporeal God with a, you know, a body of flesh and bones, and his son Jesus Christ also being that way, and, you know, not the kind of ethereal spirit matter without any, you know, body parts or anything, because as you stated in Genesis, it talks about our being created in his image. And one way that you can define or understand what one passage of the Bible means is by reading another portion written by the same author. And for example, in Genesis chapter 5, it talks about Adam and how he begat a son in his own image and likeness. And so, of course, that's what you know what that means. God looks like us. We look like God. Of course, he's a perfected, omniscient, you know, deity being far beyond what we are at this time. But I just thought that was very interesting. Same thing with the concept of heaven and hell. Our belief is that this world will be, you know, in the future, after Christ's reign, it will be changed and glorified, and those that qualify will be living in this world. And, you know, it'll be much better than it is now, of course. But just wanted to point that out, and there is a religion that is actually teaching those concepts. You know, we believe now that there are prophets and apostles, similar to the church that Christ set up when he was on the earth. And
all right, very good. Get your reaction.
Well, yes, I'm familiar with the teachings of the Mormon Church. They are a fascinating, fascinating organization. I found this out. There's no reason why anybody else couldn't find it out. I've studied Joe Smith and how these the writings of the Book of Mormon came about. I question a lot of the origins of those things. But it's much simpler this way. That's the whole thing. It is so much easier to think of God as a real thing. And when you get to the point where as I do, there are only two things in the sky, George, and the God and the aliens, God and the UFOs. Each one of them incredibly powerful, so much powerful than we are. If we just start thinking that they're the same thing, not in the sense, you know, it's just God wants to be respected. That's the whole thing behind all this. He just wants you to know that he's the power behind all this. He's the big guy. If he has a dictatorial sense, but if he has the right sense about him, and if he does care about the health and well-being and the psychological well-being of human beings around the world, if he wants us to be happy, if he wants us to be healthy, if he wants us to be progressive, if he wants us to take care of one another, then I'll take him. I'll let him run the place. That's fine with me. And I do believe that that is the nature of God. The Old Testament is full of a lot of very strange things, but that was the Old Testament. When Jesus came, everything changed when Jesus came to the planet. Everything changed, and he wrote one law. He was asked what the greatest law was, and he said, it is love. It is love God and love your fellow man. The two are equal. It is all about love. He said, on that one law hang all of the laws and all the prophecies. In other words, what he was saying is that everything in the Bible is all about love. And you see that in every other major religion around the world. And that's something we're slowly coming around to realizing is the case.
Indeed. Let's go to our West of the Rockies, Mark in Rialto, California. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing, you guys?
Just fine.
I wanted to ask you about, or actually share some information with you about WyattMuseum.com. Have you ever checked out that website?
No, I haven't.
Personally. I have. Isn't he the one who was looking for Noah's Ark?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, there they have a lot of archaeological evidence about Sodom and Gomorrah, Noah's Ark, and that will help you to identify the actual proof of the fire and brimstone falling from heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And also, I wanted to share something that's real important. that there is two entities that we're dealing with, Satan, of course, you know that, and God and his angels. But in Revelation 12, if I can read this real quick, it says here, verse 7, then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels went forth to battle with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. See, this tells us that the angels, Satan and his angels, and God and his angels, Michael and his angels, have craft or chariots, okay? And the one important thing that the Bible warns us about is that Satan comes first portraying Christ, pretending to be Christ.
Where do you find that?
That's Revelation chapter 6.
No, I mean where Satan is coming portraying Christ.
Well, that's what he does. That's his character. He wanted to have the mercy seat to begin with, you see. And in Revelation 6, verse 1 and 2, the very first speaking of the seals, it's speaking of Antichrist comes first. And if you look up that word bow and you see a rider on a white horse, and he had a bow. Well, that word bow is the Greek word toxon in the Greek, and that means cheapest fabric. It's a cheap imitation. Because, see, here in Revelation chapter 12, it tells us that when Satan is cast to earth, he knows he has but a short season, you see. Yeah. So he goes, and what does he try to do? He tries to get people to worship him.
Well, what we get is interpretation.
Right.
And
well, I do believe that we have a God here in this country, in this world. I believe it's called money. And, of course, we know that the Bible says the root of all evil is the love of money. And that word love comes from the word avarice. And we worship our toys, we worship our cars, we worship our sports teams. We have a lot of gods in this world. And
I've heard many people say, your God is green.
Yeah.
I guess that means money. Let's go to Anna in Pennsylvania. Go ahead, Anna.
Hi. I've been listening with interest, and without trying to take too much time, I'd like to ask you to go back and reread some of the prophets of the Old Testament. I'm looking here at Amos, and I'm looking at Zechariah, because not only do they talk about prophecies that were to be fulfilled in ancient times, but they also talk about another time to come. And in Revelation chapter 20, when Jesus left the earth, first of all, in the Gospels, he says, I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go, I will come again and take you there. And then in Revelation, it talks about the powers of the earth coming together to fight at Armageddon. And at that point, Jesus is supposed to return and set down his foot on the Mount of Olives. And it says, unless he would come to stop that, no man would survive. And then at that point in Revelation 20, it says that Satan is bound for 1,000 years, at which time then Christ will rule on earth for 1,000 years. But after that time, Satan will be loosed for a short time. And in that, at that point, then Satan will be defeated by Jesus, and he will be cast into the lake of fire, and those who remain.
All right, let's not read the whole thing there, Anna. But what do you think about the second coming? You think he's coming in a UFO, don't you, Patrick?
Well, I do believe that. But what's fascinating about that? Now, I agree with what she's saying. She says it very well, although I disagree about whether Satan has that much power. I think we've given him way too much power. He is not that strong. He's defeated at every turn. Every time he's come up against God, he's defeated. He's like the court gesture more than a threat against humanity. And he's only mentioned a very, very few times in the Bible. He's just overemphasized because of his evil role. I do not think that Satan plays a tremendous role in this. I believe that he will be. I believe that Satan is using the most powerful device against humanity that you could imagine, the power of greed. And I think that's what's happening. I ascribe a lot of this. I don't believe that Satan is somewhere in some cave somewhere with a bunch of hooded figures around him and fires and goat heads all over the place. I believe that if Satan is on this planet, he is sitting in a boardroom somewhere.
You might be right there. First-time caller, Dean in Bloomington, Indiana. Go ahead, Dean.
Hi, Mr. Neary. It's good to hear your voice. I wanted to ask Patrick to make one more UFO Bible connection, which was the Star of Bethlehem. But I also wanted to ask him a question about the War of the Vimana in the Indian Vedas. Is there any chance that that could have been the literal war between Satan and Michael? I never thought of that before, you know.
Well, I'm not. They have their own stories. I'm not. I don't study the Mahabharata that much, or the Veda that much. But definitely, the Star of Bethlehem is absolutely fascinating. They have had astronomers and astrologists, and everybody else has gotten involved in this. But what it says very clearly is that these three wise men, they're actually Oriental scientists is the proper definition of the word wise men. They came, they were told, somebody or something told them that of the exact date of Jesus' birth, and they came to Judea to find him. And when they got there, they were led by what is called a star. Now, that star went before them, and that star stopped and hovered over the place where Jesus was. That is not a star. That is a bright light in the sky guiding them. And of course, we see a number of instances where UFOs are guiding or incredible things are guiding people. The Exodus guided at least over a million people out of Egypt and kept them wandering around in the desert for 40 years, fed and clothed them the entire time. So being guides is not unusual, and I definitely believe that it was not a star. Stars don't go in front of people and don't stop over places.
Well, that's true. Next up, let's get one more call in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Frank, go ahead.
Hi. I'll make this as quick as I can. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Yes. Okay. Just to set the base, I've been studying the Bible in Hebrew and Greek for about 10 years now, pretty much for the same reasons that you started doing the studies that you've been doing. And I had a question about a couple of things that I found in my studies. One of them is the very first verse in the Bible, in the beginning, the world was void and without form. My studies show that actually should say that in a beginning, the world became void without form. And I believe that's in reference to the Bible talks of at least three different earth ages, one before the one that we're in now and one to come later. The other one I wanted to get your take on is when Eve was made from Adam's rib, my findings, the word translated as rib is actually a word that describes a shape, and that shape would be a flattened spiral, which I believe is kind of a hint towards the helix curve or DNA. And then the last thing I had for you, which I forgot to tell your screener about, is...
Well, let's just go with these because we got just 45 seconds left. Patrick?
Okay. Insofar as tohu and bohu, I'm sure you're referring to those two words.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that I agree with you. Definitely agree with you about that. And if you look up the words form and void in any concordance, you'll find them in Jeremiah, and you should read that. That describes a time before this creation happened when there were cities and birds flying in the sky. It's absolutely fascinating. So, yes, I agree about that. And that's a fascinating thing. Somehow or another, he needed something from Adam to make Eve. And that's interesting, the spiral, the helix that you're speaking of.
Indeed
yes.
It is. Patrick, my friend, have a good Thanksgiving with you and your family and your loved ones.
Yes, you do the same. It's been a pleasure to be with you, George.
For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.